This is Jim Cotter. Welcome to our Creatively Speaking show archive. Our ability to present these programs online is supported by WRTI's listener members. If you're already a member, thanks so much. If you're not a member, why not, while you're listening, click on the Become a Member link on the left of all WRTI.org webpages. Your support is vital to ensure we can continue to produce this and all of the other programming you hear on WRTI. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
Hello, I'm Susan Lewis, in for Jim Cotter. On this week's show, we go beyond the Gross Clinic controversy to profile the artist, Thomas Akins, and explore his multifaceted legacy to Philadelphia. Merity Duddleston looks at how art is more and more being collected as an investment rather than for its aesthetic value. Jason Pfeiffer looks at the growing popularity of children's theater and speaks with the creators and producers of several family-oriented productions in Philadelphia. And Jim Cotter talks to tenor Carl Tanner. His latest CD is a celebration of great Christmas hymns and carols. That's all ahead this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
In just 10 days, the fate of Thomas Akins' masterpiece, The Gross Clinic, will be decided. On December 26th, ownership of the painting will pass from Thomas Jefferson University to one of two partnerships, either one between the as-yet-unconstructed Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Arkansas and the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., or one between the Philadelphia Museum of Art and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. But who is the man behind the work? Why are he and his paintings so important to Philadelphia? Akins is a familiar name to most Philadelphians, even those who never set foot in an art museum. There's Akins Oval, the circular drive at the end of the Benjamin Franklin Parkway in front of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. There's the Akins Regatta that takes place on the Schuylkill River every fall. And Philadelphia's renowned mural arts program is housed in Akins' home on Mount Vernon Street. Born in 1844, Akins lived, painted, taught art, and died in Philadelphia. Temple University art historian Susanna Gold suggests that part of his appeal is because he embraced the city beyond its museum walls and communicated that in his work.
For example, I think he's taken several Philadelphia landmarks and things that are immediately recognizable to the community of Philadelphia and included them in a number of his paintings. The Schuylkill River, the Girard Avenue Bridge. And I think it's not only just these landmarks, but it's also the people that he paints within these scenes that incorporate these landmarks.
The son of a calligrapher who did his lettering on geometric grids, Thomas Akins also showed a careful attention to detail, says Kim Sayet, deputy director of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts.
He's often considered as much a sort of a scientific observer as he is an artist. To him, there was as much art in science as there was science in art.
Akins was drawn to science even as a high school student when he attended medical surgeries like the one depicted in the Gross Clinic. But after graduating from Central High School, he studied at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts and headed to Europe for 4 years. In Paris, his teacher was Jean-Léon Gérôme. In Spain, he studied Spanish Baroque masters like Velázquez and Ribera, who painted realistic works with dramatic darks and lights. Akins returned home inflamed with ideas that would make him both revered and rebuffed. Kathleen Foster, curator of American art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, says he was considered eccentric.
Because he would bear down very hard on the facts. He refused to idealize. And that was kind of going against the grain of the period. So his insistence on the details of everyday life puzzled his contemporaries. But Akins really believed in painting what was before him, and he felt that it was beautiful.
What was before him was life in Philadelphia. With some family money behind him, Akins was not dependent on commissions to live, and so for the most part, he painted what he liked. Rowers on the Schuylkill, people swimming, people singing, portraits of those he admired, like the poet Walt Whitman, and of course, doctors in surgery. The Gross Clinic is one of Akins' earlier works, painted when he was just 31 years old. It shows Dr. Samuel Gross removing a piece of bone from a boy's leg, blood slippery and red on the surgeon's hand. In it, we can see Akins' fascination with medicine, his admiration for Dr. Gross, and his devotion to realism. Kim Sayet says the painting was also to be a bold public declaration.
He was going to send it into the Centennial Exhibition, which was the major showcase of Philadelphia to the world, and he based it on a Rembrandt, which was terribly audacious for an American, of all things, a 17th century Dutch picture of Dr. Telp's anatomy lesson. And it was a really clear statement of saying, I live in Philadelphia, but I'm part of the world, and I'm staking my claim.
However reminiscent of Rembrandt, the painting's graphic imagery shocked the organizers of the exhibition, who rejected it from the art gallery in Memorial Hall. Instead, it was displayed with medical equipment. Akins went on to teach at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, where his passion and methodology revolutionized the teaching of art, says Foster.
It went from a sort of sleepy place to one of the most rigorous art schools in the world, and a remarkably revolutionary school, too, because it accepted women students. So the women students were in there in the anatomy and dissection classes along with the men and were getting this kind of high-powered training.
His rigor and passion did not make him an easy person, says Sayet. But his principled dedication led him to buck traditional attitudes about people as well.
It's fairly legendary, for example, that he supported Ossawa Tanner, who was an African-American artist who really was not accepted in any other school in America. And yet Thomas Akins really said, this guy can paint, and that was all that mattered.
This uncompromising commitment to science and art and to teaching anyone with talent eventually got him into trouble. Kathleen Foster says that the cornerstone of his education in France was working from a nude model, and he wanted his students to have that experience.
However, in Philadelphia, they didn't enjoy the idea of totally nude models, and there actually was a policy at the academy that in a mixed-sex class, they weren't supposed to take the loincloth off. There was not supposed to be total nudity for male models.
Thomas Akins said to the female students, if you're really going to draw men, you better look at all of them.
After an occasion in which the loincloth was removed, Akins was dismissed from the academy in 1886. He continued to paint, his later works like those earlier reflecting both his personal interests and his continuing observation of Philadelphians and their accomplishments. In 1889, he painted the Agnew Clinic, which, like the Gross Clinic, is a portrait of a physician in surgery, in this case performing a mastectomy. Temple professor Susanna Gold says this later work, now on loan from the University of Pennsylvania to the Philadelphia Museum of Art, was also testament to the advances being made by the Philadelphia medical community.
Breast cancer was a fatal illness, and the mastectomy was not an operation that had a very positive outlook. So because Agnew is performing this very risky operation, that suggests a confidence and an advance in medicine and a very progressive attitude.
By 1900, respect for Akins and his work had grown. Kim Sayet says that the Academy tried to reconcile with Akins. They even gave him a gold medal.
And the story is he came and rode in on his bike, received the gold medal, and then promptly rode away to the nearest foundry and melted it down. He wasn't going to forget.
During his lifetime, Akins sold few paintings, although one sale was the Gross Clinic, for $200. When he died in 1916, most of his work was still in Philadelphia, much of it in his house on Mount Vernon Street. In the years that followed, his widow placed selected works with museums and collections around the country. A large collection was donated to the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and the Academy has archives from Akins' student, Charles Bregler, with photographs, letters, and sketchbooks. But Philadelphia still lays claim to this artist and this man, and the Gross Clinic in particular seems to have taken a magnetic hold on Philadelphia's collective psyche. Is it the circumstance of its creation for Philadelphia's glorious centennial? The bold technique of an artistic master? The startling subject of a pioneering surgeon? Maybe a bit of all of these. The controversy has, in some ways, transcended the image. The picture has become a symbol that taps into a sense of communal pride, of who Philadelphians have been, who we are, and what we might become.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
When it comes to owning and buying art, there's a vast financial expanse between the museum gallery and the living room wall. This week, Merity Duddleston takes a look at the business of investing in fine art.
Try to find an Andy Warhol silkscreen of a Campbell's soup can for less than $50,000 today, and you're likely to end up buying an art book for the coffee table. But that doesn't mean people aren't spending more and more disposable income on original works of art in the more attainable range of $300, $3,000, or even $30,000.
At $4,000 with the lady at $4,000, all done at $4,000, all done, $4,000, 654, 4,000, thank you.
America's oldest auction house, Freeman's on Chestnut Street in Philadelphia, is auctioning 149 works of fine art. An auction large enough for a range of mostly 19th century European and American works, but small enough, according to auctioneer Alistair Nicol, to keep people from falling asleep at the back of the room. David Donaldson of Freeman's.
10 years ago, it might have been 90% dealers buying the merchandise. Now it's actually switched to the opposite. We are in the 85-90% private buyers are prevailing in the fine art sales over the dealers.
And people are looking for other ways to invest their money. And art has become one of those ways.
Nancy Smith is an investment advisor at Glenmead Trust.
We all know about the money that has been made on real estate over the past few years. Well, that's been going on as this economy has become richer and richer and richer, and art's just part of that.
The increase in private buyers of art is generating new financial products and services. Title insurance for works of art, for example, and fine art indices tracking the appreciation, or not, of art as an investment. The best known is the Mae Moses Fine Art Index, first published around 2001. Two professors from NYU's business school, John Ping Mae and Michael Moses, analyzed repeated sales of thousands and thousands of fine art pieces sold at auction starting in 1875. Smith says Glenmead compared the Mae Moses All Art Index to 16 other asset classes and risk levels, including real estate, venture capital, bonds, and stocks, over 20 years ending 2005. And art, she says, performs just like the other groups.
Each year, they jump all over the place from being the best to the worst, somewhere in between, and the art index does exactly the same thing. And if we average out for the 20-year period, we find out that the art index comes up right in the middle.
There's actually other sets we have that were actually used during fires to call out instructions and whatnot, but they're not silver, obviously.
Artifacts and artwork from the collection of the Green Tree Company, one of the first fire insurance companies in the United States, are on display in the second floor of the Schwartz Gallery on Chestnut Street. Robert Schwartz Jr., a third-generation dealer, sees a common mistake among neophyte collectors.
The most common error would be buying a name and not a piece. So, which sort of speaks to buying the best of something. They'll buy a very poorly done or quickly done or just, you know, every artist has a bad day, if not many. And someone will say, well, this is a Rembrandt Peale, so I'm going to buy it and it's wonderful and it's a great investment piece, but they don't like it and it's a bad piece. It's just not well done. He had a bad day and people are buying a name and they're not buying what they're looking at, which is really what you need to make a judgment based on.
This sentiment is echoed by Myron Coonan, a private collector whose pre-1950 American masterpieces make up the exhibit Villa America, American Moderns, 1900 through 1950, currently at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts.
People are competing with a lot of money for names that are meaningful. But a meaningful name doesn't mean a good artist. It doesn't mean a good painting, to my judgment. And everybody should judge these things for themselves. Do you like it or don't you like it? Do you want it or don't you want it? And that shouldn't be what they say in the books about the artist.
That's not to say having a gut instinct isn't an acquired skill.
You can't go to classes and learn this kind of stuff. You've got to go around and look at 1,000 paintings, and you'll know more at the end of the process than when you came in the first time.
And as in every other area, from real estate to cars to refrigerators, the Internet has opened up a world of comparative pricing information. That's had a dramatic impact on the market over the last few years, in the view of Freeman's auctioneer, Alistair Nicol.
So what we're finding increasingly is that collectors and private buyers are going to specific art sites where they can see what paintings have made at auction, and so they're doing their own research. They're finding out for themselves.
Researching an artist with an auction history in art databases like ArtFact, ArtNet, or AskArt is undoubtedly a sensible start, just like building a diversified investment portfolio. And while technology, online databases, and financial studies have turned art into a new investment frontier, the value of any particular artwork still can't be assessed with scientific accuracy. Unlike stocks and bonds, art is still, at its core, something to be experienced on an emotional level. So invest in something you like, be it contemporary, impressionist, or folk art, so whatever turns the market takes, its personal value will endure, and you'll like what's on your living room wall.
WRTI's Meredy Duddleston. The holiday season often brings out a childlike enthusiasm in people. For many, family-oriented theater shows have become a regular part of the season's celebration. Take a quick scan of theater listings in the Philadelphia area, and you'll see that a handful of the largest regional theaters are offering such shows. Robin Hood is at the People's Light and Theater. The BFG, or the Big Friendly Giant, is at the Arden Theater. And The Frog Bride opens at the Philadelphia Theater Company on Friday. Now WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer looks into these shows for young audiences and finds an emerging trend.
Theater for children and the family is certainly not a new idea. It's long been a strong tradition in Europe, for example, especially around the holidays. But historically, it hasn't been taken as seriously among professional theater companies in the United States. There have been some exceptions. Seattle Children's Theater, one of the country's largest resident theaters for young audiences, was started in 1975. And the Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis, founded in 1965, is widely considered the gold standard of North American theater for young audiences. In 2002, the Minneapolis company premiered the children's theater smash hit A Year with Frog and Toad, which eventually made its way to Broadway.
Hello, Toad.
Hello, Frog.
What are you doing in my dream?
Well, funny, I was about to ask you the same thing.
Oh, well, it certainly is nice to see you.
I feel the same way. How has your winter been?
Well, I'm hibernating, so there isn't much to report.
It's about the same for me. This is a very nice dream, though.
Yes, it is.
In 2004, the Arden Theater Company staged A Year with Frog and Toad, and the production received critical acclaim, picking up 2 Barrymore Awards. Arden artistic director Terry Nolan points out that this sort of recognition for a children's show in Philadelphia reflects a shift in attitudes about the theater genre, in contrast to nearly 10 years ago when, according to Nolan, local newspapers rarely reviewed or covered such productions. Although that's changed, he says similar aversions still remain among many people.
A lot of times we have this idea that children's theater is second rate or it's second tier, it's something that you have the interns do, and there are a lot of theaters that do that. And so it has the same sort of negative connotation at times as bad productions of A Christmas Carol. That's something people do to exploit the opportunity, not for artistic reasons.
When the Arden started their children's theater series 9 years ago, they were determined to use the same talent, time, money, and energy as they would for any regular adult-oriented production. Maureen Sweeney, director of education for the Philadelphia Theater Company, says this sort of dedication to theater for young audiences is becoming much more common in the U.S., particularly within the past 5 years.
The growth that we're seeing in the genre, I feel like, is a response to families wanting to do something together. It's not just something that schools can go to for a class trip. It's not just kids' theater shows that, you know, are books that they're reading in school, but families are really seeking out entertainment. Whereas children's literature and TV and movies, all of that kept right up to pace with the quality level that parents were demanding for their kids. And theater really hadn't done that for a while. It had been doing it in pockets and, you know, Minneapolis and, you know, some of the bigger children's theater-based companies, but not as a whole. And now we are seeing that happening.
Productions designed with young audiences in mind involve various approaches and take different forms. This is reflected in the mere wording that's used to market these type of shows. One company might call their production family theater to avoid the potential baggage that can be associated with children's theater. The phrase children's theater can imply that the production values are subpar, that it's performed by children, or it only appeals to children. While recognizing these sort of pitfalls, some companies, like the Arden Theater, still prefer the children's theater label. Artistic director Terry Nolan.
One of the reasons we call it Arden Children's Theater is it's first and foremost for kids. So that's our audience. I like that there are some adults who come see our children's theater productions without kids. I think that's great. But it is for kids.
Meanwhile, the Philadelphia Theater Company bills The Frog Bride as a production for the whole family. In the view of David Gonzalez, the creator and performer of the show based on a Russian fairy tale, there's a distinction between theater for children and family theater.
Family theater that I'm interested in is, you might want to call, intergenerational theater as well. That is, an elder can see their life in these myths and stories and presentations, the art values, as well as a youngster, as well as a middle-aged man or woman.
Semantic nuances aside, family theater and children's theater are, at the least, both very intentional about including and appealing to young audiences. This affects how the shows are conceived, written, and produced in many ways. For example, lewd and complex political material is usually not appropriate for young viewers. But Whit McLaughlin, who directed the BFG and other children's theater productions at the Arden Theater, explains that for him, the difference between directing a show for young people and a show strictly for adults is not drastic.
You want to avoid the sort of simplified, simplistic, quote-unquote, children's theater feeling, which is important themes dealt with simplistically. Now, children don't want a certain complexity, but they want humanness in there. So that enriches what's at the heart of these plays. I think it takes an adult sensibility to be able to kind of understand that for children.
McLaughlin adds that when a children's theater show has high production values and provides a deeply imaginative experience, it should, on some level, speak to the childlike nature in everyone, not just one age bracket. In light of the success of Disney Broadway shows like Beauty and the Beast, The Lion King, Tarzan, and Mary Poppins, it's evident that there's money to be made in the children's and family theater genre, and that prospect has likely helped fuel the recent surge in theater for young audiences. And, it seems, the genre will continue to grow in the coming years. But people like the Arden Theater's Terry Nolan caution that there is a danger in the motivations of some companies getting involved in the field, hoping to discover a cash cow.
If it becomes a financially driven concern, if theaters start doing it in order to generate additional income, then I don't think that bodes well for the development of the art. If theaters do it for the same reasons they do their best theatrical work, because it's their passion, because they really care, because they really believe that this says something of value, if they're fueled by those motivations, then the field can just explode and really be enriched.
And as conventional wisdom goes, exposing young audiences to high-quality, solidly crafted theater now will go a long way in cultivating tomorrow's audiences.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. In case you're interested in catching some of the shows mentioned in that report, Robin Hood is at the People's Light and Theater through December 31st. The BFG is at the Arden Theater through January 28th. And The Frog Bride will be at the Philadelphia Theater Company from December 22nd through the 30th. Tenor Carl Tanner is well known for his unusual path to his now hugely successful musical career. Before becoming an opera star, he worked as a trucker, then became a bounty hunter chasing down bail jumpers and fugitives. Although he discovered his singing voice in his final years at high school and studied music at Shenandoah Conservatory, he didn't begin to seriously pursue this career until his early 30s. Carl Tanner's musical calling is now in full bloom. He regularly performs on the world's great opera stages, in recitals, and as an orchestra soloist. Tanner's latest CD, Hear the Angel Voices, is a collection of his favorite Christmas songs and carols. He spoke recently with WRTI's Jim Cotter.
Let's talk about your relationship with O Holy Night. Is this something that you were singing in those days in the truck when you were doing other things besides being a professional opera singer?
Absolutely. You know, there's a toss-up. I can't really remember, but either the Lord's Prayer or O Holy Night was the first piece I learned to sing. And I'm pretty sure it was O Holy Night. And I learned it probably when I was about 15 and a half, 16 years old. And it was something that fit then, and I was singing baritone. And it was just something that felt so more than comfortable. I mean, opera was something that it had to be taught to me. But the Lord's Prayer, Christmas music, O Holy Night, Panis Angelicus, those pieces, and especially O Holy Night, was a piece that just felt so natural to me. It was almost like I'd known all about it before.
So at what point did you decide that you wanted to record O Holy Night along with these other great holiday songs on this new CD?
Well, I started singing O Holy Night in little churches in the Washington area. And before I knew it, major churches and major organizations and television shows and the Pope and everybody around the world wanted me to sing O Holy Night at their church and on their television show. And I guess it's the way I sing it. I'd like to think it's the music itself because I think it's everybody's favorite Christmas piece. So I decided to make an album. And then once the ball really got rolling and I started getting people involved and I hired Jack McCracken, the record producer, then it came to fruition in March of this year that we flew out to Seattle and used the Northwest Symphonia and the Northwest – or the Seattle Choir and the Northwest Boy Choir to put it all together. I really didn't even then know how beautiful the album would come out. When I got out there to Seattle and we recorded – all the orchestral and the choir, the choral tracks in Seattle. Listening to the music, I thought, wow, I think we have something special here. And, you know, the tenor's okay. But, I mean, the background music, I mean, the orchestra is phenomenal. And
it's a really huge sound, isn't it? Yeah. Choose another track for us and maybe tell us a story about your relationship with another song on the album.
If you listen to All Is Well, All Is Well is a piece that Michael W. Smith wrote about 22 years ago, and I think no one really recorded it right away. And then Michael Crawford recorded it a couple of years ago. And I think the Philadelphia Boy Choir actually recorded it. When I heard it, it didn't really hit me. But then they rearranged it and they orchestrated it and it changed the orchestration for me. But All Is Well is really special. And if you listen to it, it's one that you probably never heard before. And I think it'll really become famous now because this is a really beautifully, I mean, the choirs and the orchestra, lush sounds of the orchestra, it's a really gorgeous piece.
Spent a great deal of time with this album, both in the recording and the preparation. Are you now able to sit back and listen to it as a listener might? And if so, what will we be hearing around Shea Tanner this Christmas if you were to pick one track from the album?
You know, to answer your question, I'm not able to sit back and listen to it as a listener might. I'm highly critical, but if I sit back and listen to it, I listen to either Panis Angelicus or I listen to the Lord's Prayer or Holy Night.
Panis Angelicus from Hear the Angel Voices, the latest CD from Carl Tanner. He was speaking with WRTI's Jim Cotter. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Dominic Mercier, Norman Keyes, Rebecca Shapiro, Debbie Fleischman, and Karen Gross. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore. And I'm Susan Lewis, in for Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.